And now, CBS Radio brings you Ma Perkins.
How long has it been since you've heard that?
Oh, I've heard it because I hear it on the old record.
they put them out now. They're very popular. I very often play them on
this program.
I hesitated asking Virginia Payne to come here today because in researching Ma Perkins, I found that you did 7,065 broadcasts. Can you stand a 66?
That's right. Well, it isn't the same kind, is it?
No, quite different. How long has it been off the air now?
It went off in 1960.
Yeah. Was it a sad day?
Well, in a sense, it was, because it was a breaking up of a very closely knit group. In another sense, it was really helpful for me because the Ma Perkins program was confining. I was rarely ever written out, and only in the very last years were we able to record in order to take any kind of vacation. And I was interested in theater all the time, so immediately after it went off, I went into theater and have stayed there ever since.
You did two broadcasts a day for a while, too, didn't you?
Oh, we did more than that. We did three broadcasts for a very long time, and sometimes four. And then, of course, I did other series. So many times I did as many as seven in a day.
Good heavens. You began in Cincinnati, right?
That's right.
Is that where you're from?
Yes. Cincinnati, Ohio was my
home. There last week.
Yes. It's a beautiful city, isn't it?
Yeah. I
hope you weren't there in the tornado.
I just missed it.
That was dreadful.
Just missed it.
They had a dreadful tornado.
Someone mentioned WLW as being the station where Ma Perkins began.
Right.
And I remember your telling me once that it stood for World's Lowest Wages.
Right.
Still got a big laugh when I mentioned it.
Yeah, people laughed. This was one of the in-jokes of the group at the time who were employed there. But, of course, it was really a marvelous station. They called it also the Cradle of Stars. And it was one of the most powerful stations in the United States, as I suppose I said. It was 500,000 watts.
Clear channel, I think.
And our mail map on the early days, we were there, you see, as a 15-week tryout when we originated Ma Perkins. And the mail on the mail map was simply astonishing. I have it someplace among the memorabilia. And it's blanketed the nation. We've had enormous mails from Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas, and all over the country.
One of the things I want to ask you about, you told me, well, I think when we first met about 4.5 years ago, and we didn't go into it on the air, was that when the program began, the character of Ma Perkins was quite different than the one that evolved. Can you elaborate a little on that?
That's true. They had originally envisioned it as a Marie Dressler character, and that was the way I won the audition in Shouting. A woman, the Tugboat Annie, was rather popular at the time. And they thought of a woman who was continuing her husband's lumber yard and who would be that kind of brash, boisterous lady. And that, as I say, is the way I won the audition. But it occurred to me, and I shouted my way through a good many of those first 16 weeks. It occurred to me that when one had only voice, and when you couldn't see the twinkle in Marie Dressler's eye, and you couldn't see the smile playing around her lips and take the curse off of all that shouting, that it was likely to be rather unpleasant. So I toned it down, and of course, eventually she became quite a gentle person.
Well, the scripts must have had to be changed, too, subtly and a bit at a time.
Somewhat, yes, somewhat. Although she was never a disagreeable character. I don't mean that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She was loud and raucous and more raunchy. I don't think it would have... they also did later a radio version of Tugboat Annie, not the same people. But there was a version of that, and it didn't last very long. It isn't pleasant to hear a woman being shrewish on radio.
No, and Ma, the Ma Perkins I remember was anything
very
but
gentle,
shrewd.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah, she changed the character.
Yeah. She, I'm sure she was the most popular of all the serials that my grandmother listened to. I was much more the...
Jack Armstrong type.
Well, yeah, I listened to him after school, but during the day, if I'd come home for lunch, which I usually did, I would listen to The Romance of Helen Trent.
Ah, yes.
And many times my grandmother's friend, Maud Hemmerling, isn't that a wonderful Midwestern name?
Yes, that sounds like
lived across
Vic
the street.
And Faith.
Yeah. And Maud was from Indiana. She was a real American, she used to say. And we
real
were in
American.
Detroit. Yeah. And she said she didn't understand why I would listen to that Helen Trent, because she was only interested in the tinsel of this world, Helen Trent.
Oh, that's lovely.
Whereas I told that to Julia Stevens.
That's lovely.
Whereas Ma, she said, was a real person. She was down to earth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she was a real person. She had a great understanding. She was rather a timeless character. And a composite, I suppose, of everyone's mother, grandmother, or Aunt Mary, or somebody. But she, you know, she had a lot of instinctive sense, and she wasn't an educated woman, and I think that was part of the charm. She was she knew less than anyone. And some of the descriptions I read of it are really very interesting, because I think they're written by people who didn't listen to it. Because they act as if she was a know-it-all and a busybody. She wasn't.
Oh, no.
She wasn't.
Anything
she wasn't.
No.
She wasn't one of those snoopy grandmas or any of those foxy grandpas or any of that. She was a very tolerant person, and she truly tried to live to the golden rule. And she was a very good listener, which... I think, you know, it seems to me that she was like a non-directive social worker that we have today, the listening ear. She listened, and there were many, many young people in the script, and there was much humor, and that's never brought out. They always talk about all the perils and the trials and the weeping and this, that, and the other. We didn't dwell upon that. We had very few murder trials. We didn't do any of those usual plots. We didn't have amnesia. We didn't have murder trials. And we had very simple plots in many instances of people who lost. We for example, we did an interesting thing, it seems to me, as the play went along. We tried to show the evolution of the small town. Whereas we began with names like Perkins and Smith and Brown, we began to show the change that happened in the town. And we involved... Lonnie Konvalinka was the man at the filming station, and we did a long sequence.
I love that. Lonnie what?
Konvalinka. Lonnie Konvalinka. But we departed, you know, from those Simon Pure American names, that concept of the black and the white, and the not black and the white in the racial sense, but the black and white in the clearly drawn terms, I mean. But to try to incorporate some of the gray, we try to show how a town changes. Then we had a whole group of people on the outskirts of the town of Bohemian ancestry, Kalachek. And that was very interesting. At the end, the last program, we had a young girl named Anushka who was trying to find her place in the town, so-called typical American town, where she was a second-generation Bohemian girl and of quite a different culture. And a woman wrote to us, and quite a lengthy letter. And she said she was so interested because it was her maiden name, and it was the only time that she had heard it consistently, correctly pronounced by a group of American people. But you see, there were those settlements, particularly around on the outskirts of Chicago and around Chicago. That was a great melting pot.
Yeah, there were Poles and Lithuanians.
Exactly, exactly.
Bohemians.
Bohemians.
Yeah. Did Ma Perkins originate from Cincinnati because of Oxydol? Is that the home of Procter & Gamble?
Yes, it is. It is the home. I don't know whether it was that or whether because they felt that WLW itself would be a good test station.
Oh, well, the reason I asked that is I don't remember another network show coming
no,
from
that's
Cincinnati.
True. No,
were there others?
No. There was one earlier that you mentioned, Eric Bino. Eric wrote the earliest thing that Procter & Gamble sponsored called The Puddle Family, which remained only a local broadcast. But I think that's true, that it was the only one, isn't it? You see, it was one of the first, it was the first of the Procter & Gamble sponsorships. And it was a revolutionary move for them. They had never done any broadcasting. And you can understand how successful it's become when you consider what a big advertiser they are. But they'd been interested in print advertising.
You mentioned Eric Bino again, and as long as we brought the subject, I want to tell the listeners, because I expect that anyone listening to this program is interested in radio and the history of radio, and there's been a number of things done on it, and nothing that I know of comes anywhere near being what Mr. Barnow has done in two volumes that are published by the Oxford University Press. The first is called A Tower in Babel, and it's the history of broadcasting in the United States from, I think, 1922 until 1933. The second volume, which is the one I've been reading, is called The Golden Web, and it's also published by Oxford University Press. That's the history of broadcasting from 33 until 53,
mm-hmm.
And there's a third volume, I don't know the name of it, it's going to be out within the next year. And I'd highly recommend it to anyone who is interested in really in-depth studies. By in-depth, I don't mean a terribly bone-dry, serious thing. Because it's not, although it is absolutely full of facts. As a matter of fact...
Well, Eric is a very bright... He was a fine writer.
He's a marvelous researcher.
Yes, I'm sure of that. He's an excellent writer to begin with, and then he also was a teacher of broadcasting. And, of course, he knows. I think so much of the material that has emerged, is... myth. It's strange because there are things that are stated as facts about our program that are absolutely false. And once they're printed, that seems to give them an authenticity, and everybody copies that. For example, they keep saying that we were a product of Frank and Ann Hummert. We were nothing of the kind. They had nothing to do with the program. And that has been repeated and repeated. I've seen it, it said over and over, but we weren't one of those. Broadcast. We were eventually handled by Dan Fitzgerald and Sample, but we weren't one of those Hummert productions. Ever.
Yes, Mrs. Hummert is still living. Anne Hummert, she's either in or around New York, because I know Arthur Hughes sees her. I talk to Mr. Hughes quite often on the phone. But I've asked him to appear on the program, because I would think she'd be fascinating.
I should think so, too.
But he said she's a very retiring woman.
They never took very much limelight at any time.
Yes, he told me that. So did Julie Stevens.
Yes.
She said they were not the people...
I didn't know them, you see, because we weren't associated with them, as well as they did. Both Arthur and Julie would have known them better, because those were their productions.
I thought of a great trivia question, which I hope you can answer, because I haven't found it in any other book on Ma. What was Ma's first name?
We never called her anything. We had an early sequence which went back. It was a flashback sequence, because in which we showed Pa as a young man, and Paul was played by the son, John, in that episode, in a younger version of himself, you see. And then I think she was referred to as Evie, which was her daughter's name.
Well, she had two daughters, Evie and Faye.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Evie was the one that my grandmother used to always say was a heartache to Mom.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's true. Well, I believe that's the way the sequence began, because Evie decided that, and that was true, Evie was always the one who was a bit out of step. She was very individualistic and foreshadowed a modern attitude.
And modern, I think, is the word they
modern,
would use.
Very modern.
Very modern.
Yes, you are.
She was the president of the Jolly
17. 17, that's right. Marvelous character. Great fun.
Yeah. You probably got most mail on her. I know you got an awful lot of mail, you told me before.
Well, on all of them. I know that Faye, too. When Faye married, that was a very interesting. And Faye's children. And the loss of John. Of course, we lost John in the war, his son. And that all those things. Everybody wrote, you know, various people wrote about them. But I think essentially they really wrote they liked the comfort of Ma. It was nice to know she was in the world. There was somebody like that too, who would know what to do.
I'd like to know someone like that.
Would too. Wouldn't we all?
Did you keep in touch with many of the people? You were the original,
yes,
or the only Ma Perkins, but were
That's
you the
right.
only one who was with the show from the beginning to the end?
Yeah, well, Mary Forbes, who played Willie, was with it through 25 years of its life, and he came with us when we went to the network, which was after the first 16 weeks. He was with us from the time we began on the network, which is almost a full length of time. And Charlie Eggleston, who played Shuffle, was with us until the time he died. He died a year before the broadcast went off in 1960. And but he throughout his life, he played with us. The three of us were together.
I heard it.
Quite a wonderful record.
I heard a commercial not too long ago on radio, and I was going to call you and ask you if you were on it. It was for apple juice.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's
was
mine.
It?
Yes, that's
yeah.
mine.
Yeah, and there was a fellow playing the facsimile of Shuffle.
Yes, probably.
It was very funny, by the
it
way.
It is cute. I think they're grandsons.
Yeah. What were you called on
we
that?
Won a
it wasn't
prize.
That person.
No, Apple Granny.
Apple Granny. I fell on the floor when it came
I
on.
Think they're very clever.
They are.
That man writes wonderful copy.
Yeah. When you moved to Chicago, it must have been at the time that city was the big hub of East Coast radio, or radio on the East Coast.
Yes.
What were some of the other shows that were emanating from there at that time?
Well, Irene Wicker's Singing Lady was there, Mrs. Grant, Amos and Andy, and Chris Nighting, Grand Hotel, Jack Armstrong, Captain Midnight, Bertha Nanny, Betty and Bob, Painted Dreams, Guiding Light. Try to think of schedule. Then there were many that meantime have gone on.
Was Sibber McGee and Molly from
Sibber and Molly.
I know you knew Marion
yes.
Jordan.
Oh, yes,
that
very well, very well. I played in that. And to go into the nighttime one. The Contented Hour is pretty safe. And your good friend Lawrence Welk. And Red Skelton was another there. And Gary Moore and Ransom Sherman.
Merton Marge.
Merton Marge.
I talked with her quite recently on the phone, Myrtle Vale. She's still living in Chicago.
Yes. Is that so?
Yeah. And I talked with Jim Jordan about a month ago.
Oh,
I
love
him.
They're so darling.
Yeah. Well,
wonderful.
He remarried, you know, after
Marion
or Molly, as people know her, died. He remarried a woman who is the widow of a dialect comedian, and I can't think of his name, but they're living out in West L.A.
I remember that I heard it at the time, but I've sort of forgotten.
Yeah, and I'll tell you who I spent most of the day with is Charles Correll.
Oh, yeah.
With Andy on Amos and Andy. He's still very close friends with his partner, Freeman Johnson.
They were remarkable partnerships.
They made an awful lot of money. He
oh, I'm
living
sure.
in a beautiful
oh,
home
course.
In the in the Truesdale estate.
Yeah.
I think some of the other people I saw when I was on the coast from radio, Cliff Edwards, ukulele.
Yeah.
So many people think he's dead because he's really on in years.
Yes.
But he's not. And Walter O'Keefe.
Yes.
Who lives in Playa del Rey, I guess it is. It's way down the coast, anyway. Jimmy Fiddler.
Mm-hmm.
Who I got such a kick out of because I had no idea what he looked like. So many of the people from radio, I guess people don't know what you look like.
No, of course not, no.
No. But they might, do they ever still remember the voice?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure, I think so, yeah.
How did you, I don't understand about that. When you started, you must have been a very young woman. How did you manage the older voice?
Well, I changed my voice. I didn't use my own voice.
Yeah, of course, the Ma voice, even you used, is not exactly like yours now.
No.
It's much more, much more...
frail and aged.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we all did. I did many, many thousands of characters, which rather amazed the people. And one day, a girl who shared my dressing room at the theater in Houston was astonished. You know, when I said I had done other things, he said, oh, I didn't realize that. I said, heavens, yes, as I said to you, we did some 7 broadcasts today. I did a Lion Tamer, long sequences of Lion Tamer on Jack Armstrong. And I did Mama Schultz, a German mother on Today's Children. And I did an Irish mother. It wasn't Mother Monahan. She was well known in the Painted Dreams, but Mother somebody else. And all sorts of things on Grand Hotel and Chris Snyder and the world's best novels and a cute comedic character on a series called Hot Copy. There was a newspaper story and rather mystery. There was some fascinating programs. When you think of the scope of the programming, it was quite wonderful.
I was on one of those talkback radio shows in, I think, Los Angeles a few months ago, and one of the callers rang up and said, did I know whatever became of Ma Perkins?
Oh, for goodness.
And I said, yes, she lives in New York, and she has a house in Maine, and I said I had seen her about a year ago because she came by the after offices to pose for a picture when we had all the radio stars together. And he said, well, right now she's in Houston. And he told me what play you were doing.
Oh, that's
interesting. And he said she was superb. Mm-hmm. So that's a very nice compliment because he didn't know you. He didn't know you at all.
Yeah. How good. How interesting.
Yeah. That's very nice, I think. Very nice compliment for you.
Well, it's been, general, I've found a, you know, wonderful acceptance there, too. The interesting thing, I suppose, most of us are quite facile because it's fun to try to create a character. And I have always thought that radio is a marvelous medium. I don't think it was never, ever fully developed as it should have been because it's such an imaginative medium.
Mm.
And I also think it's one of its powers. I think it's one of the reasons that people remember us so well and remember the details of the stories and all that sort of thing is because they were so involved. It invited their participation to such a great extent.
It'll be interesting to see in a few years how well the television soap operas are remembered.
Yes.
You know, perhaps they will be as well remembered. I don't know.
Yes. I have a feeling that maybe they won't. But not only from the standpoint of the medium, but because there are so many, too. I think people now have so much entertainment that I don't believe there is a... although I might be wrong about the soap operas, because they really demand great loyalty and command great loyalty from fans.
Of course, it's such a different world, you know.
The time is so fought for now, you know.
When Ma was on the air. Now, for instance, I remember Ma Perkins being on twice a day, like Pepper Young, a number of them.
Yes.
And in the Midwest, if one did the washing in the morning, you listened to Ma Perkins in the afternoon. And vice versa.
Right.
Well, I don't know. They have electric, you know, automatic washers and automatic dryers, and the housewife we think of today, as we're always told by ad agencies, at least the young housewife. I don't know what happened to the middle-aged housewife or the older housewife. Nothing seems to be pitched to her today.
I don't think it's true of the. I think the young housewife is just as busy as those people were. You know, she's just as busy around her house. It's true that. That she's more mobile, perhaps, but she has the shopping center adjacent, and she drives a great deal and all that. But I, all the young housewives I know are at home a great deal of the time with the children and have big families and are just as busy as those other people were and are just as, you know, listen.
She's probably much more sophisticated, though, don't you think?
Yes, I think so. But the stories change with, I often think of sequences that the way we would do them today, because we are the things were always timely of their own time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was just that we've just moved to a different position. You know, we'd have hippies and we had, at that time, we had a long sequence about a an actor from Hollywood who was very dissolute, who was found drunk on our lawn one time and shocked the community, and Ma made a great plea for him that he lived by different standards and all that sort of thing. So I think that's simply a matter of a storyline, you know.
Well, if I were a hippie and I were passing through Rushville Center or any place like that,
Ma.
I certainly want to see Ma. Because
well, she'd be one that would feed you, I could tell you
she'd
that.
She'd be the only one I know of up there.
I think that's probably true. And yeah. she never approved of the small town. That's why I say that it interests me to hear the things that are said about her by the, because she was always trying to push back the ideas of the town and not live by the small prejudices and move on out. She had a great curiosity about people and a good listening ear.
Well, I know Variety said, and I think they meant facetiously, but there's also element of truth in it when they said that Ma Perkins was just plain Bill in drag.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was the only other character that I can think of on the air was really a very decent, tolerant man who was concerned with other people's troubles really more than his own.
Papa David was, too. I think, you know, that it more or less represented the ideal of the time. And, of course, it was concerned with a different kind of problem because, as I say, in that instance, you had And for example, the prejudices would center about second generation Americans or the Jewish problem. Or you see, the black problem at that point hadn't become so prominent, and particularly in those Midwestern sections, so there weren't that many black citizens. And also, but there were many second generation Americans. Of what was thought of as foreign elements.
Yeah, names like Lamparson.
Exactly.
Like
that. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, we tried to incorporate that into our story, and that was a big departure to go. You see, because the tendency was to move with the stereotypes.
People find that hard to believe, I think, today.
I think so, too.
Young
because,
people. But
oh, they laughed us off because, you see, that. And also, the story very much mirrored the times. I've done a number of interviews with people who were writing theses and trying to trace the mores of the time frame. And it unquestionably did. When we began a story of a mortgage and foreclosure of a mortgage, was an important plot because it was a fear that hung over people well after the legislation of the 30s with the FHA and the veterans loans and that sort of thing. You see, that problem disappeared.
Well, the common expression, they lost their home.
They lost
their property.
That's
it happened many times in our neighborhood.
It's a matter of the depression, you see. And so that those were timely problems. I mean, as you say, they're dated now. They don't seem important, but they were.
Even the matter of the name, I know that I was from, I'm from Detroit, which is considered a big city, but still it's in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And when my parents came from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which is a big Polish settlement, they were miners, they changed their name. They don't use the name Lamparsky even today.
Yes,
because my father couldn't get a job in Detroit.
Of course.
Which is thought of as a Polish settlement.
Yes. And this was true of John Hodiak came.
Right.
I don't know whether you remember John.
He was from
John
Hamtramck, Michigan.
Yes, and from the Ukrainian
section,
his whole family. And, you know, there was serious talk about his changing his name. And John was there. Was a wonderful friend of all ours, and we were friends of his. And these were real problems at this time.
How did we use up 29 minutes?
I don't know.
We're really out of time.
It's
I had all kinds of other kinds of things.
I said I was such a good listener. I didn't prove it, did I?
No. You're a good listener and a good talker. A friend of mine said when he listened, I told him I was going to record this today, an interview with Ma Perkins, and he said, well, I don't know if I'm going to listen to that. He said, I might just psychologically get a cold. I always associate Ma Perkins with an earache or a whooping cough.
Right.
But he said if he didn't get a cold, he'd sit around the radio and eat peanut
cute.
Butter sandwiches.
Oh,
also...
lovely. They always tell me that, you know, so many people have been wanting me to write a book, and I think they're enough books. But I kept thinking if I read it, I'd call it. I heard you when I was sick.
Well, I hope no one listening is sick.
Oh, don't be sick. Be well.
Sue, this has been very enjoyable. This is the second time I've talked with Virginia Payne, but we had such a good time the last time that I thought I'd ask her back after 4.5 years. And we've been talking about the character she played from... 27 years, was it? 27? 27 years on network radio. Occidental Zone, Ma Perkins. And thanks, Virginia Payne, for being here.
Right, thank you.
Until next week at the same time, this is Richard Lamposky. Thank you for listening. Good night.